Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. It's Newsday, Kieran, but I just wanted to say something at the start, mainly Kieran, because I'm never sure how many people are still listening at the end, to be perfectly honest. Once they've had a little sprinkling of football finance and a large dollop of 70s music nostalgia and some carry-on style humour, I'm not sure how many of them are still there, but I just wanted to say a massive thank you to all of you who sent me such kind messages of goodwill. I've read them all. I haven't replied to them all because there's just so many, but I have read them all, and I'm overwhelmed at the love and affection that was shown to me, and it really does mean a lot to me. So thank you everybody for that. Thank you for your kind words, Kieran. They really were appreciated. And now let's never mention it again in true manly style.
Okay.
We're South London blokes. Enough of this South London bloke sentiment. But talking of South London blokes, and I couldn't have been more proud of my club at the weekend, not only the 2-0 win, but the messages of affection I had from them. But interesting financial news coming out of Crystal Palace today, Kieran.
Yes. What we've seen is that there are some documents which have been sent to Companies House, which appear to indicate that John Textor, who is the new investor, it looks as if he's put in around about £5 million into the club. But at the same time, he's ended up with somewhere between a quarter and a half of the ownership. Now, you know, Crystal Palace is worth a lot more than you know, four times £5 million. So one can only assume that what has happened is that he has bought shares from other shareholders. There's two ways for a person to buy into any business, including a football club. A, that person buys shares from the other shareholders, and B, the club or the company physically issues shares and receives cash. So it looks as if it's been a bit of cash for the club and an awful lot more cash for the other shareholders. If the I think it's been mooted that he's put in around about £87 million in total. So that's where we stand at present. You know, clearly you're closer to Palace and you know the other Palace fans who I've got to know over the course of this show are that much closer. But it's good that they have lodged the document, so we do have a bit more transparency, and I think it would be useful if the club just clarified the position.
Well, it's an interesting one, Kieran, because I thought they had, and a brief check with other Palace fans in the WhatsApp group tonight, including the lovely Princess Julian, who you met, who fanboyed all over you in the pub before the Brighton game, who's very interested in football finance. We were all of the opinion that we thought he had invested £80 million. This was the figure we thought we had in our heads. And when the investment was introduced, it was specifically talked about as being investment in the infrastructure. So this is interesting that he seems to be buying more shares. Is this, excuse me, is this a sign, Kieran, that he might be trying to acquire a bigger chunk of the club? Or
no, I think some of the other shareholders are diluting their investment, and it could be that they're cashing in. And it could be that he, you know, another document gets lodged in a few days' time, which says he's bought more shares. So I can only go on what I've seen in the public domain to date. But clearly, he's you know he is a significant investor in Palace, there does appear to be now quite a broad range of people from a variety of industries who have put money into the club. I think it's no surprise that the money's coming from the USA, because all the noises that I'm getting from a lot of people connected to investors is that they do feel that the Premier League in particular is vastly undervalued. And it's trying to unlock the door as to how you can actually make a lot of money out of a business which, compared to the MLS, you know, Palace is worth around about, you know, a half to a third of a few MLS clubs. And you know, and this isn't me sucking up to you or denigrating the American football system, but you know, Palace are a much bigger item as far as global football is concerned because they're attached to the Premier League.
Yeah, in true football fan style, most Palace fans I know are sincerely wishing he doesn't think it's going to be like this all the time. That he's turned up this summer. We've got a new manager. There's a feel-good factor about us. We're beating Man City away from home. He needs to know what it's really like, nine seasons out of ten. Let's see how much money he starts putting in then. This big stories to kick off with, Kieran, I don't think it's come as any surprise, not to you. And when I first heard this noise is what we call the pod. When I first heard the news, my initial reaction was, I wonder what sort of dancing shoes Kieran's going to be putting on. Is he going to be putting on jazz dancing shoes or ballet dancing shoes? Because the former FIFA president, Sepp Blatter, and the former UEFA boss, Michel Platini, have been charged with fraud, Kieran. Big news.
Yes. They have both been subject to sanctions from FIFA in respect of 2 million Swiss francs, which was given to Michel Platini by FIFA in around about 2010, 2011. Now, according to Blatter and Platini, this was in respect of a verbal contract between the two individuals. Now, a verbal contract is enforceable. The trouble is, you know, who can actually, apart from the two parties involved, there's nobody else in the room, who can say that contract ever took place? And that's why, you know, we always say get things in writing and get things signed and get things approved. Platini said that he wasn't initially paid the money because FIFA was skint, which to me seems a little bit strange because FIFA is not as wealthy as UEFA because it's only generating money once every 4 years, but it's still not a pauper. As well as FIFA getting involved, and FIFA had suspended the individuals, the Swiss federal authorities started to investigate around about 6 years ago, and they have now come up with a threat of fraud and misappropriation of funds of FIFA. So they're effectively acting on behalf of FIFA with regard to this. The two people involved, you know, Sepp Blatter's 85, Michel Platini's, I think he's late 60s. They're claiming it's all for consultancy work. Now, you know, I remember investigating the accounts of a few companies in the entertainment industry, and they always used to have an unusual expense heading called chocolate and flowers. I go, they spend a fortune on chocolate and flowers, and then I sort of, you know, and always cash payments as well. So it does appear to be something which, you know, consultancy is a very, very vague word. And I subsequently also found out that these chocolate and flowers appear to be quite powdered when I eventually traced back to the source of the supply, and I decided to go and investigate no further because I was quite attached to my kneecaps in those days, I wanted to remain in a similar frame of mind.
Yeah, I remember thinking, Kieran, in my early days in show business, these people are very excited about the chocolate arriving.
Yes.
This is 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock in the morning seems a strange time for a man on a motorbike to be delivering chocolate. As soon as you hear the phrase verbal contract, I mean, that's the sort of thing your Uncle Terry would say. We had a verbal contract. I promised I'd beat him up if he didn't pay me the money, so he paid me the money. But $2 million, I mean, that's not the sort of amount. That's not a mate saying, can you lend me 50 quid? That's immediately sounds suspicious, doesn't it? So who's charged them? Is it the Swiss government have charged them with fraud?
It's the Swiss federal authority, yes. So, right. I think the Swiss legal system is conscious that perhaps historically it's not had the greatest of press with regards to the way it's looked after money, and therefore it now really has tried to up the game in certain regards. And you know, it's the Swiss authority is also very proud that FIFA is based in Switzerland, and they want to protect the organisation itself. And they've done that in their view because they believe that this money has been inappropriately given to Michel Platini on the say of Sepp Blatter. And you know, we don't know the details, and presumably they will come out. But you know, neither of these guys are in the first flush of youth, so you know, it could. It could grind on for some time, but I think they're quite anxious to accelerate the prosecution as quickly as they can.
West Ham's owners are selling a big chunk of the club for £175 million and amid rumours that they might be offloading the whole thing in a year or so.
Yes. The interest here is coming from a guy called Daniel Kretinsky, who is a he's based in the Czech Republic. He's a very successful investor. And if the stories are true, he's buying just over a quarter of the club for, you know, somewhere in the region of 150 to 200 million pounds. That values West Ham at 600, 700 million pounds. Which you know, is a lot of money. It's twice the amount that that Newcastle United went for only last month. But the issues with regards to, well, why is he just buying a quarter of it, appear to be linked to the position of the two Davids, Gold and Sullivan, in that they have an agreement with LLDC, who are the previous owners of the London Stadium, or still the former owners, that if they do sell the club at a profit, then 20% of the profits would go to LLDC if that takes place before 2023. So what we've got here is Daniel Kretinsky. If this goes ahead, then he builds up a minority stake with a view to a potential takeover in 2023, and David Gold and David Sullivan, from a sharing of profits point of view, will be able to keep the profits for themselves. At the same time, I think they are both sort of, you know, in an ideal world, want some status still to remain at the club, whether it's life president or some sort of gong, because yeah, they. In their view, that they have rescued the club when it did have a lot of problem with the former Icelandic owners. They've lent money to the club, although they have charged interest for it. And at present, you know, West Ham are looking absolutely fantastic on the pitch as well.
The valuation is interesting, Kieran, because it's not that long ago that David Gold was saying it's worth £1 billion at least.
Yes, I mean, if you go to Karen Brady's personal website, I think she said they turned down an offer of £800 million, and I've been talking to some people who have got, you know, vacant, you know, indirect and direct connections, and they see that they reiterate that was a genuine bid, but that David Gold and David Sullivan felt that undervalued the club at the time. So it looks as if they are going to accept a lower figure. You know, I always felt that £1 billion for a stadium where you don't have control over it, you're effectively renting it. It's not like Spurs' stadium where, you know, they can use it for NFL, they can use it for concerts. That they are very much utilizing all the facilities within the property asset to maximize a return. You know, West Ham make around about 27, 28 million pounds a year from matchday income. Spurs, in a full season, I can see them making around about 120. So there is a big gap there. And I think that's reflected in the values of both clubs.
So how much would West Ham be worth if they stayed at Upton Park, the bowling ground, whatever they call it, depending on what mood they were in at the time?
I would have put them in the 300 to 350 million pound bracket at the old stadium. So it's certainly beneficial, the move from the owner's point of view, because, you know, that they have got this increased capacity. I think there is the opportunity with more hospitality on match days to make money as well. And if you're trying to sell the club to commercial partners and sponsors, The former Olympic Stadium does look quite spectacular, even though, you know, it's from a spectator point of view, it's not a football stadium.
Yeah, here's a club, Kieran, that we haven't spoken about really since the very early days of the pod, when you used to patiently explain to me how not to run a club, and it's Hull City, and their owners have confirmed that they are in discussions now to sell the club.
Yes, so the Alarm family have been trying to divest Hull City since the club was last in the Premier League, which was as recently as 2016. Yeah. And I think at the time they were looking to sell it for around about £120 million. That price has tapered and tapered since then. And it looks at today as if they're probably going to accept somewhere in the region of, say, £20 to £25 million with some top-ups should the club get promoted to the Premier League. But what they have done is they have put out a statement. They've offered a period of exclusivity to a Turkish investor called, and apologies if I mispronounce his name, Akon İlikalı. He is involved in the media. He is what we might refer to as a TV mogul in cliche world. And it looks as if he's got the money to put down a deposit on buying the club. But there appears to be indications or suggestions that the remainder of the money might have to come in installments, or he might have to get funding from a consortium. So he doesn't necessarily appear to have a huge amount of cash, which will no doubt disappoint Hull City fans, because everybody hopes that when a new owner comes in, the first thing they do out is they get out a blank checkbook and start splashing the cash on players. And Hull City have had a fairly mixed period of success since they were relegated from the Premier League. I'm a little bit concerned about Mr. İlikalı, because he was involved in a Dutch club called Fortuna Sittard, and I think he withdrew his involvement there because he seemed to want to get involved perhaps on a more day-to-day basis. And having owners who think they know a lot about football isn't necessarily a good thing. And also, if we take a look at some of the comments which he's made with regards to Hull City, is that he wants to have Turkish players there at the club, perhaps a Turkish manager. My view is if the Turkish manager and the Turkish players are the best in the business, then you recruit them. But you don't recruit a player or a manager because of nationality. You recruit them because of ability. And I'm a huge believer in a meritocracy. How that would work, especially with the points-based system that we have in terms of governing body endorsements for recruitment, I could be challenging. But we'll have to wait and see with regards to that.
Well, if they do shake hands on a deal, you'd like to think that the last thing the current owner says as he leaves the club is, oh, by the way, don't try and change the name of the team in the first week. That's not going to pan out well for you.
Yeah, very, so very, never very wise indeed. Yes, and I think it's still. I think it now really grates with Hull City fans that the name of the company that owns the club is Hull City Tigers Limited, even though the name of the football club isn't.
Again, it's one of those clubs, Kieran. It's almost impossible. It's like Plymouth Argyle. It's almost impossible to discuss Hull without wondering why they haven't become a bigger football team. Now, I know they've had seasons in the Premier League, but they've got Newcastle bang on about being a one club town. The whole city are just as much as that, and it's not isolated, but it's got its own unique sort of ecosystem out there. And it potentially it's a huge club, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I remember when we were campaigning for a new stadium at Brighton, driving up there and dropping in a 6-foot Valentine's card to John Prescott, who was the the MP at the time.
Yeah,
you weren't expecting that, were you?
Did that work? I wasn't expecting that. No, it wasn't just from you, Kieran, was it? You didn't love
it. No, to be fair, it was... It was from love from all of us on the South Coast. Well, it did work in the sense that he approved the planning permission for the ground, and otherwise we'd still be in that god awful place at Withdean.
Yeah, very nice selection of whiskey in John Prescott's office. I can't tell you the details of how I was in there drinking it, but and also I've got a couple of mates who are Hull City fans, and just to annoy my mates who are Hull City fans, I'm just going to leave this item with these three words, in fact, white telephone boxes. It drives them up the wall. There's more to our bloody town than white telephone boxes, you know. It's like, oh, no, you've got white telephone. It's the first thing every Cockney says the first time they go to an away game in Hull. The telephone boxes are white. What's going on? You stop random strangers in the street in Hull. Go, what's the matter with your telephone box, mate? It's the wrong colour.
Great music scene, though, in Hull.
I never really forgave the House Martins for naming that album title. It's one of the reasons why Londoners are so. One of the reasons why the London football fan is so popular across the country, because you just smell your phone box, mate. This is an interesting one, Kieran. Oxford United, their prospective new owner plans to move the club to a new stadium, which is odd because the old one has only recently been redeveloped.
Yes. We have a director of the club. Again, apologies for my mangling of his name, Anindya Barry. He's presently a director of the club. He's from Indonesia, and he's trying to put together an offer which will allow him to take over the club from the present owners. The Kasam Stadium only has a 12,500 capacity. I think it's still only got three sides to it.
Yes, it has. There's an end. Yeah. An end missing. Yeah,
yeah.
And, or two. And technically, before somebody tweets in, two sides and two ends.
Okay,
there's an end missing.
Yeah.
You know what our listeners are like. You know the accountants that listen to this show are like, God love them.
Well, the lease on the stadium expires in 2026, so they've only got another 4.5-5 seasons left. So Mr. Barry has said that he wants a sustainable club. He wants the club to be carbon neutral. I believe he's been speaking at COP26 as well. He says, if we have to have a new stadium, provided it is close to the present location, he wants it to be as central as possible, which would be my concern, because if anybody's ever seen property prices in Oxford, they are pretty eye-watering. So, to get a big land expanse there, which would be big enough for a football ground, would be quite a challenge. But again, it's a club that has had ups and downs and a series of owners. I think you and I are both old enough to remember going to the Manor Ground when Oxford had a fantastic run of form. John Aldridge and Dean Saunders and those type of players. Ray Houghton, absolutely. And since then, the club has been in the doldrums. So, another new owner potentially, another foreign owner potentially. Lots of people who still see value in the English football system. You've got to wonder how they're going to extract money themselves, unless they want to be just benevolent owners.
Yeah, and based on the history of that club back in the day that you're talking about, Kieran, another mental note for a new owner: don't try and merge them with Reading. They won't like that. Neither of them will like that. Strange story when Robert Maxwell tried to merge Oxford and Reading into the Thames Valley Royals. Now, this next story, Kieran, I noticed on your social media today, you seemed quite worried about this. You used the phrase, it's squeaky sphincter time for Huddersfield fans, because their chairman, Phil Hodgkinson, his legal firm has gone into administration.
Yes. Huddersfield was sold by their previous owner, who gave 75% of the club to Phil Hodgkinson, who appears to be paying for the instalments partially through parachute payments. And Huddersfield Town, they were in the Premier League for two seasons, which means that they get 3 years worth of parachute payments, but they are going to taper off. Mr. Hodgson runs a company called Pure Legal. I'm not going to call them a bunch of ambulance chasers, Kevin, because that wouldn't be right. But if you take a look at the reviews of Pure Legal on Google reviews, they score 2.3 out of 5, which isn't great. And they have gone into administration. And, you know, first and foremost, your concern has got to be for people who potentially are going to lose their jobs. And I think there are 9 companies involved. But if Mr. Hodgson is not making money from Pure Legal, he's certainly not making money from owning a football club in the Championship, because, you know, as we know, it's a license to lose money. So how is he going to pay the ongoing costs? How is he going to pay the outstanding instalments with regards to his commitments to the previous owner is a little bit up in the air. So, as always, we just hope that, the nature of the history of my work, as far as finance is concerned, does tend to be sort of, you know, a bit on the Eeyore side of things in terms of cheerfulness. And perhaps I'm being a bit over pessimistic here, but I would be concerned that if you've got a club that's got operational losses and has got financial commitments to previous owners, where is that money going to come from? And also the focus of Phil Hodgson is presumably going to be to try to assist the administrators as much as possible to have a business which can be sold on to somebody else in his main business.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Ally's Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
You do occasionally veer into the private Fraser, Chris Whitty, we're doomed mode, don't you? But that's based on experience. But I mean, unfortunately, again, as I say, unfortunately, a lot of this is based on history and tradition, but Huddersfield surely are an attractive proposition for potential buyers, aren't they?
Yes, they are. I'd expect there to be interest. And remember, they are not in administration themselves. It's just a case of what is now going to happen. You know, is the previous owner, Dean, who sold the club because his health wasn't great. Is he going to come back? Is he going to be paying the wages? He's a lifelong fan of the club. There's a bit of uncertainty. And, I'm a great believer in, the one thing we know about the future is that it is uncertain, but to try to minimize the volatilities is something I always prefer in all aspects of life. Dullness is there's a lot to be said for it.
Yeah, if I was a Huddersfield fan, Ken, I'd be slightly concerned by that pause and then that before you answered the question, they spoke volumes. Now, Kieran, here's a blast from the past, a slice of podcast history, a name we thought we'd consigned to the dustbin, but unfortunately, he's like Elmo. He's lifted the lid. He's crawled out. He's back. It's Steve Dale, and Steve Dale has applied for his company, Dale Acquisitions Limited, to be restored after previously being struck off. Is this significant for Berry, Kieran?
Well, my only concern here, Kevin, is that this is coming at around about the same time as we had the recent announcements with regards to the sale of Gig Lane. And Steve Dale had this company called Dale Acquisitions, and in classic Steve Dale style. He couldn't be asked submitting accounts. He didn't do that for 5 years. The company was subsequently struck off, as you know, the government authorities eventually get round to doing, and nobody thought any more of it. And then for it to suddenly be resurrected, sort of Jason Voorhees style from Friday the 13th movies, was, you know, took me by surprise. And then he submitted 5 years worth of accounts as well, unaudited accounts. So, you know, how reliable they are is open to question. But nothing happened in them for 4 years. And then in the final year, the one asset which the company had was sold at a huge loss. And now he has a company which is in existence, but which is technically insolvent. It just seems very strange, you know, that this is happening just after the administrator says that there has been progress with regards to what's happening at Gig Lane, with regards to, you know, in an ideal world, some form of Bury Football Club will return, and you know, that would be absolutely fantastic. You know, anybody that's monitored Steve Dale's behaviour since his first involvement with Bury Football Club will always be twitchy, because there are people who know the system and who know how to play the system. And I can only go back to my former life in the world of insolvency. You know that you're dealing with bottom dwellers, they, you know, there is a role for scavengers in the corporate world. And some of them are better than others, and some of them do actually, you know, resurrect companies and preserve jobs. That doesn't seem to be the case with Steve Dale. So that's why I'm just a little bit nervous that this company that we thought no longer existed is suddenly back amongst the living.
I'll have to take your word on Friday the 13th, Kieran. I've never seen it. I don't like scary films. I have to watch Carry On Screaming, and I can only watch in small doses.
Well, there's a good reason for that.
It's hilarious. It's just if I find that quite scary. Horror films and roller coasters, I just don't understand why they exist. Mm. It's like Ali loves the more dangerous a roller coaster is, you can't stop her. Ed, when we took Ed to Disneyland when he was little, it was me and him on the teacups all day. And Alice in Wonderland, and Ali, seriously, he's the same. He's as big a wuss as I was. Like, no, and Ali was doing all the roller coasters for the whole day. It's like, well, even it's just, well, mind you, it's a small world after all. He's fucking scary, isn't it? That's the most sinister thing I've ever. My apologies for it. Again, this we got halfway through, Kieran, and we were still the BAFTA people were still listening, and suddenly he's talking about the teacups at Disney World. This is why we're not winning anything, Kieran. Although we think we might have been nominated for something at the FSA Awards, but we're not quite sure what it is.
We have definitely been nominated for something. We just don't quite know what that something is.
I think it's you that's been nominated. It's best online media, but whatever it is, vote for us, people. yes. The EFL, Kieran. So again, any other pod would have a whole 5 minutes at the end telling people how they could vote for us. And just you and I just go, I think we've been nominated for something. I'm not sure. You can vote for us if you find out how to do it. Like, this is producer guy. We're doing his nut as he listens to this. Producer guy specifically said, make a point about telling them to vote. No, it's tawdry, producer guy. Kieran and I are above that sort of thing. Or is this our subtle way of saying vote for us? Who knows? The EFL, Kieran, I thought to be exploring changes to the punishments they hand out to clubs that go into administration.
Yes, this was a report which came out in one of the tabloids, whose name I will not mention. I think reading the second-hand reports of it, the EFL appears to be unhappy with clubs making appeals against points deductions, which were supposed to be automatic when a club goes into administration. So we saw in 2020 the administrators of Wigan Athletic, they put in an appeal. It cost around about £300,000. That money came out of the coffers of the club. So effectively, that money was paid for by the unsecured creditors of Wigan Athletic. And that appeal failed. appeal failed, and those costs therefore had to be borne by the unsecured creditors in terms of their final dividend. What has also appears to be happening with regards to Derby County is that their administrators are potentially going down the same route. They are saying that because of the impact of COVID, that was the main driving force which caused Derby County to go into administration, along with the EFL refusing to lend money to Derby. And it's got absolutely nothing at all to do with the mismanagement and financial gamble. Yep. That was taken by Mel Morris. So that's the approach they're taking. Why are they willing to do that? It's because from a risk and return point of view, the risk is you spend £300,000-£400,000 on an appeal, and if you are successful, you get an additional chance of playing in the Championship, and that brings you in an extra £6 to £7 million in terms of TV money and other revenues. So, from a risk and return point of view, you can see why the administrators are taking this approach. The noises which came via this report were that if a firm of administrators is going to appeal against administration, then that money has to come out of the administrators' own coffers rather than that of the administration process itself. I.e., effectively, they're taking on it from a personal liability point of view. I'm not convinced that legally that would work, but I'm not a lawyer. But the other thing is that if a club does appeal against going into administration and loses the appeal, as we saw happen with Wigan Athletic, then the alternative would be an automatic 6-point further penalty. It's a bit like if somebody's up on a court case, if you plead guilty, then the judge is going to probably give you a lower sentence than if you appeal, claim to be not guilty. So that's the story. We don't know how much meat is on those particular bones. But it's certainly been mentioned in the local Derbyshire press and at least one of the nationals. So you can understand it from the perspective of the administrator, that if they feel that they're acting in the best interest in the club in the long run, but also from the EFL's point of view, that if everybody who goes into administration puts in for an appeal and blames it on COVID and blames it on the EFL and blames it on everybody else, then they want to punish the clubs involved. And this does appear to have some support amongst club owners, especially those owners who perhaps have run the clubs on a more sustainable basis.
You kind of can't blame the clubs, though. If there's almost no negative sanction towards an appeal, no matter how frivolous it is, and you might as well do it, as you say. So, they just want to cut out the frivolous appeals, essentially, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, £300,000 is a lot of money. Remember, 20 members of staff have been made redundant at Derby County. And it does appear a little bit harsh that the administrators can't find the money to pay for those former members of staff, but can find a lot of money to go and pay accountants and lawyers.
Yeah, fair point. It seemed very odd, Kieran, on Sunday, I believe it was. The days were a bit muddled, as you'd understand at the moment, to hear some Tottenham fans booing Harry Kane. And no doubt that's one of the reasons that Nuno Espirito Santo has been sacked by the club after just 4 months. But you've been looking at the numbers and you think he's been hard done by.
Well, it's not a case of hard done by, but we have this phrase, the big six, and in my view, I don't think we should be making reference to a big six, because Spurs don't really qualify. Once you actually go deeper into the numbers, first of all, the other members of the big six have won trophies, which Spurs have failed to do. And that's not a criticism of Spurs, because there's plenty of clubs. If you look at the trophy cabinets of our two clubs, then they're not exactly bulging, are they? But
the Kent Cup is the Kent. I'm going to have to stop you there, Kieran, because the Kent Cup is quite a sizable trophy.
We've got the Sussex Senior Trophy as well.
But the Kent Cup only lasted 2 years. I think it was us, Charlton, and Maidstone and Gillingham, I think. So, yeah, it's a 4-team tournament that we managed to win. We also have the Zenith Data Systems Trophy. But, you crack on if I'm sure your trophy cabinet's probably posher than ours, but our one, anybody with an allergy to silver could safely sleep in Palace's trophy cabinet without any worries.
So, where is Spurs' natural place within the football environment? So I went and took a look at what's happened in terms of Spurs finances over the course of the last decade compared to the two Manchester clubs, Liverpool, Chelsea, and Arsenal. So the other members of the sneaky six, given their behaviour towards the European Super League, perhaps that's a more appropriate reference to them. And if you take a look, Spurs' income was around about £700 million less than the other clubs over that course. Their wages were substantially below their peer group. Their transfer spend was around about a quarter of some of those other clubs. Football's an industry where money talks. So if you don't spend money on players and if you don't spend money on retention and recruitment, that will be reflected in your natural place. And, perhaps there's a case for saying that under Pochettino and also perhaps under Harry Redknapp, Spurs had two managers with whom they overperformed, did therefore the fans become used to that level of performance and success on the pitch. They did very well in terms of qualifying for the Champions League, getting to the Champions League final and so on. Since Pochettino has gone, things have gone wrong. Now, clearly my next-door neighbour, Paul, he's a Spurs fan, and I saw him earlier this week and he said it's not just that we're not getting results. It's saying it's the style of football under Nuno, which then begs the question: given that he used to play that style of football at Wolves, and remember this isn't a football show. Why on earth go and recruit him? Because it just seemed completely daft. But financially, they're underperforming.
Yeah. It's a shame this isn't a football show sometimes, Kieran, because there is a certain intangible to being a Tottenham manager, and your neighbour Paul has hit the nail on the head, because there are clubs, West Ham fans still talk about the academy, yep. Tottenham fans still talk about, even fans that are way too young to have seen that team in the 60s still talk about push and run. They expect a certain style of attractive football, and if a manager doesn't produce that, look at Mourinho. They didn't take to Mourinho, and he was relatively successful. If they don't produce that certain style of football, they're not happy. And also, his other problem, everyone knew he wasn't first choice as manager. It's as simple as that, which is a hard thing. But I imagine he his ego will be dented, but his wallet will be bulging, I guess.
Well, he was only on a 2-year contract. He will get most of that, and he certainly he wasn't in the upper echelons of manager pay. The highest paid managers in the Premier League are on close to £20 million a year, because remember they don't get paid weekly because they're management, as we've established. He's not going to be selling the big issue once he gets his payoff from Spurs.
Now, this is a story, Kieran, that we've been discussing in potentia for 2 years, and the financial implications of it as well, because Standing is returning to England in January, and Wales, technically. Actually, for the first time in 25 years. I can't be dealing with angry tweets from Wales at the moment, Kieran. The five early adopter clubs are going to be Spurs, Chelsea, Manchester United, Manchester City, and Cardiff City, which is that five? It is five, yeah.
Yeah, it is five,
So Spurs, Chelsea, it is five, yes. So I went over two lines, Kieran. So my attention span dropped at the end of the first line and then I had to go back again. So Spurs, Chelsea, Man United, Man City, and Cardiff City. Do we know how many seats are going to be turned into safe standing areas, and how will it affect the finances? Because I was just surprised to learn, Kieran, the last time we spoke about this, that you thought the standing spaces wouldn't be cheaper than actual seats.
I've got a seat and I stand. Whenever I go to a away match, I pay for a seat and I stand. Yeah. I don't expect a rebate or a reduction. So the nature of the technology is that the aim is to prevent surges. What we have at present, especially if you are an away fan, is that we've got unsafe standing in the seats at many grounds.
Yes.
And also, if you are behind the goal at many stadiums, then a section or a substantial number of people will be standing, although that is technically against the rules. And there's sort of a, don't ask, don't tell approach taken by clubs. And everybody sort of, nods along and knows what the rules are. So the proposals are that at Spurs we've got the potential for 10,000 people being able to stand. Now there is no way that Spurs will be reducing those prices. They just moved to a new stadium. I don't think fans will be particularly bothered either. I think they just prefer to stand and would like the thought of being given the opportunity to do so. The only way that prices could realistically be reduced is if we have more standing places than we had seats. So, if we get 120 standing places for every 100 seats, then yes, you could reduce the prices and still have the same or a little bit more of income. But from what I've seen to date, because they want this to be successful, they don't want to be seen to be cramming people in. And therefore, it looks like it's going to be on a one-for-one basis in terms of one lost seat equals one additional standing position. So there's no way that the clubs who have spent money, it's costing somewhere between £60 to £100, I believe, per seat to make them into something where you can stand. And we also have to take into consideration is that if some of these clubs, we've got the two Manchester clubs, we've got Spurs and Chelsea, they are playing in the Champions League or in the Europa League under UEFA rules, you have to have seats. So it's a standing area which has to be converted for European football.
And I know we have discussed this before, Kieran, but for those people who don't listen to every pod, and I've learned that there are a couple, initially, when 10 to 15 years ago the first talk of safe standing being reintroduced happened, it was from an economic basis. It was from fan groups who thought that fans had been priced out of football and that having standing areas would automatically mean they were less expensive. But clearly that isn't the case, is it, as you just explained?
No, because from the club's point of view, it's actually costing them additional money because they've had to go for these particularly engineered seats which can be converted both for standing and seating purposes. So the benefits are going to be from a personal enjoyment perspective, generate future greater atmosphere. You've only got to look at some of the German grounds and some of the amazing banks that you see there. And I think the clubs are conscious that we have gentrification of football fans, and this is a way of getting people back on their feet. But you can make more noise when you're standing. It's simply from a biological perspective as much as anything else.
Is that true? I suppose, yeah. You very rarely see singers sitting down, do you, I suppose?
Val Doonican.
Oh, okay.
That's about it. Elton John.
I was going to go Elton John, but you went even further back by going Val Doonican. To save younger listeners, Val Doonican was an Irish crooner. He used to sing in a rocking chair wearing jumper. My God, we had some terrible things to watch on TV in those days, didn't we?
Yeah, was it Paddy McGinty's
Two going more to news you stories. That was my mum used to sing me. Yeah, I never understood how he. It's, again, for those listeners who don't know, Paddy McGinty's Goat is a song about an Irishman who comes into some money, buys himself a goat, and has plans to make all sorts of butter and milk-based products, and then only too late realises that the goat is a male. It's a Billy, and yeah, it doesn't take a lot of checking. Most Irish people are from a rural background. You'd think you'd just have a quick look, wouldn't you? Wouldn't, you know, never, it always baffled me, that song. A lot of the things my mum sang baffled me, to be perfectly. Also, depended on what time of night it was she was singing them, to be perfectly honest, Kieran. Two more news. You know what I'm talking about. You hadn't, your mum's
I've got background. An Irish mother, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know, yeah. So, mother, she's, please don't wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning to show me off to. Anyway, it's not my fault. I was a beautiful child, Kieran, is it? It's two more news stories, Kieran, and one of them is a rare piece of good news for Oldham Athletic.
Yes, Oldham have got a toxic relationship between the fan base and the ownership. Their accounts are erratic, is the politest way I can describe them when they do actually put them out. And they have been subject to two embargoes from the EFL. One is in respect to what's called a monitored loan, whereby they are limited as to what they can do with money from the EFL, which has been provided. But the other one, which was a lot more serious, was they were unable to sign anybody, even players out of contract, due to some outstanding football debts. To give the EFL credit, they do now have a very good part of their website, which is called the governance section, which lists all of the outstanding transfer embargoes when they come and go. All that I would ask, it would be great if they could send out an email to us to let us know when they do change. But the eagle-eyed Oldham fans spotted that one of these embargoes has been lifted, and it will give the club a bit more flexibility with regards to trying to recruit players. Oldham aren't having the best of times, so for me, it's a classic club that I remember. For mainly bad reasons, because Oldham always used to go and slaughter us, and Mark Ward always used to score goals against us. you want football to be on as even a playing field as you can from a recruitment point of view, and to have such strict embargoes made it very difficult. But it also forced the club owners to settle the outstanding debts on transfers. So you can see why the EFL took the approach that they did.
News from the city to end with, Kieran, and it's my opportunity to say that I'm reasonably certain that my wife, Ali, loves me. I'm fairly convinced of that, and she's been absolutely wonderful this week. But it turns out, Kieran, that I've got one or two bad habits that really, really annoy her. And one of them is when she's listening to the news on BBC Radio, at the end, when they say, in the city, I have to sing at the top of my voice, there's a thousand things I want to say to you. Right? And it turns out the first time I did it, it was quite charming. But the fact that I'm still doing it, however many years later, really, how can you not do it? And Ali's point, and yeah, my point is it's never not funny. And it turns out that Ali disagrees with me. mildly amusing the first time, but not funny. But a city law firm has been fined for breaking the rules over payments to football agents.
Yes, this is a firm called Mishcon, and this relates to five transfers in relation to Premier League. And it seems to be quite technical that the lawyers were using clients' money, by the looks of it, to make payments to third parties. Now, if you are looking after money from for a client, you can't effectively act as a bank and pay off other parties out of that money. Mm. So I spoke to one of our friendly lawyers who I won't use the exact words that he said about this law firm, Mishcon, but they were not glowing with praise. It's a bit like my relationship with Arthur Anderson back in the world, wacky world of accounting. So they are a law firm who are very successful, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're popular for the right reasons or the wrong reasons. So they have been fined in relation to this. And although it was a fairly nominal fine, £25,000, they spent £507,000 on legal costs defending themselves, because clearly, wow, as a law firm, your reputation is absolutely critical. But it does show that, even in the Premier League, that there are huge sums sloshing around, and that lawyers and agents and accountants are working in conjunction with another, and there are rules that have to follow. I mean, this has been a case which has taken a long time to come to fruition. The police don't like prosecuting the police. Politicians don't like prosecuting politicians, as we're seeing with the gradual destruction of democracy in parliamentary UK. And the same is true with the legal profession. So it's not the fact that it's just a small fine. I think from reputationally, it's quite a significant issue.
Well, from huge amounts of money to little tiny amounts of money, if you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to our Always Free to Air pod, that would be very kind of you. Then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you'd like answered on our Monday show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, once again, folks, thanks for all the kind words. We do take them on board, both good and bad. If you don't want to go down the Patreon route, according to producer guy, it makes a difference if you could give us a review. If you give us 5 stars, that would be fantastic. It doesn't actually matter what you say. You could say you would prefer the show was presented by Sir David Attenborough and Dame Helen Mirren, and I would be all ears for that particular show if it ever takes place.
That's one we have to make happen. Yes, thank you for listening, and don't forget to vote for us on whatever it is we've been nominated for on the Football Supporters Association Awards. That would be very lovely. Thank you, everybody,
and thanks once again for all your kind words. Bye.
Really? There's no way we'd get nominated for that. Bye bye, everybody.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.